explanation about the content of this dua. And as I mentioned, mainly we need to pay attention to that part which talks about the covenant. Let me share one narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about Salman. He was asked the Muslims and Jude, you remember Salman a lot.
Yes.
We know that Salman is one of the people who is called Minna Ahlul Bayt. He belongs to the progeny of the Prophet, yes, the Ahlul Bayt. So by reading Dua al-Ahd, we are also trying to be the same, to be from the Ahlul Bayt and to be among the army of Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance.
Inshallah.
And Imam said that Salman had three features, and one of them was that itharuhu hawa amir al-mu'minin ala hawa nafse. He used to prefer the wishes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, over his own wishes. And this is very important.
All right.
We are not talking about, material wishes or vain desires. No, Salman is not a person like that. When it comes to our responsibilities, sometimes we need to do, we have one important task and one more important task. So Salman was a person that always he preferred wishes of the Imam, meaning that whatever Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted him to do, he used to do that. So if you're going to be among, the Ahlul Bayt, and there are some narrations in this regard, for example, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that good to those people who live at the time of the major occultation, including us, hopefully, and they are holding fast to our wilaya, to our guardianship, and they are away from our enemies, and they are from us and we are from them. So
right.
There is a big chance for us to be also like
to have
Salman,
that place
from
of Salman.
Ahlul Bayt. But the point is that we need to pay attention to that covenant, which is repeated in Dua al-Ahd, if we, of course, continue to recite it on a daily basis, hopefully.
Yes, you said so beautifully. You explained the entire content of Dua al-Ahd, and then you pondered upon the duties we have. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi,
for
being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
Yemeni men, firm faith. Part 1.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. On June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Ali Abdullah Saleh ruled Yemen for 3 decades. Before that, he was the president of North Yemen for many years. This is the museum he established to mark his own presidency after he resigned. His resignation did not mean that he wouldn't return to Yemen's political arena. Saleh had surrendered during the revolution in Yemen and delegated power to Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi and left the country for the U.S. under the pretext of medical treatment. On February 19, 2014, UN Envoy Jamal Ben Omar announced that Saleh could take part in the upcoming elections in Yemen. At that time, Saleh was pursuing his own goals and got closer to the Houthis to make a unity with them. In terms of tribal divisions, the Houthis are Zaydis, just like him, and more importantly, they're considered Yemen's main power. If he sought a future in Yemen, he had to form an alliance with the Houthis. The coalition was eventually formed on August 10, 2016, between the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh. The coalition was aimed at putting up a resistance front against Saudi raids. Parts of the Yemeni army still took orders from Saleh. The Houthis needed his power for the war. Saleh, too, needed the Houthis' influence in order to regain power. As long as they could find a solution for the Saudi attacks, it was a win-win situation for both sides. But the answer of the leader didn't trust Saleh that much. He had to choose either of the two. Mohammed bin Salman, an ambitious Saudi young man who had launched an invasion on Yemen with all of its force on the one hand, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, a Yemeni dictator who was ready to join him in the fight against Saudi Arabia for now. October 8, 2016, some horrifying news from Yemen left the world in shock. Saudi forces bombed a funeral ceremony. 155 people were killed and 525 people were wounded. The number of fatalities on that day was more than half of the fatalities during the first 2 months of Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Gradually, public opinion in the world sympathized with the Yemeni people. Images from Yemen were the most horrifying images in the world. However, Houthi revolutionaries were under immense pressure.
لم تكن شكوك السيد عبد الملك الحوثي خاطئة. سرعان ما توضح.
There was a good reason why Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, was so hesitant. Soon it came to light that Saleh was hand in glove with the Saudi-led coalition. The United Arab Emirates was supposed to play a secondary role in the war, a country behind Saudi Arabia. But UAE officials pursued their own aspirations. They know that Saudi Arabia is dreaming about becoming the regional leader and historically consider countries like the UAE as part of their own land. Saudi Arabia started a power game in Yemen, but the UAE was after business. In 2006, when the war in Yemen hadn't broken out yet, and Ali Abdullah Saleh was still Yemen's president, they signed a contract to construct a city named Al-Nur, or the City of Light. After the war broke out, Emiratis built prisons of their own. Some people were reportedly tortured in the prisons. However, it was always the UAE's humanitarian aid convoys in front of the cameras. The Emiratis had learned something that Saudi Arabia hasn't even started to think about. The UAE views the countries in the region the same way the colonial UK viewed regional countries. Saudi Arabia is after attacking, occupation, and capturing the region, just like a traditional government. But the UAE is after business. and it doesn't make any difference for it whether it was going to achieve this goal through prison and torture or humanitarian aid convoys. The important thing is to push things forward, especially since Yemen's energy resources, including its oil and gas, are still intact. For companies, the temptation is so big that they will even get involved in bloody games. From November 28, 2017, the streets in Sana'a were scenes of clashes between Saleh loyalists and the Houthis. On December 2nd, Saleh appeared on Yemen's state television and called on the people to wrest back the country's control from the Houthis. What had happened? Why did the alliance between Saleh and the Houthis end so quickly in a year? The Houthis answered the question 2 days later. On December 4th, 2017, Mohammed Abdul Salam, the Houthi spokesman, told Al Jazeera that Saleh had clandestine ties with Saudi Arabia and certain other Arab countries for 3 months. Saleh seemingly sided with the Ansarullah resistance, but he negotiated with enemy representatives behind the scenes and was ready to make a peace deal with them. For Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Saleh was a traitor. The street clashes by Saleh's supporters to occupy the Houthis' headquarters failed. It was strange that no domestic force could defeat the Houthis. And the big question was, if the Houthis were merely a tribal group with no relevance to the national will in Yemen, and if they didn't enjoy support from the Yemeni people, why was it so hard to defeat them? The easiest answer for bin Salman was to point the finger at Iran. Iranian officials never denied that they were supporting the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni people, even though the support is mostly spiritual. At the same time, Iranian officials are pessimistic about bin Salman's aspirations. Bin Salman doesn't have sufficient experience to lead a region, and his short record in Yemen doesn't promise a bright future. People in Yemen are in a very tough situation. On April 21, 2015, when Saudi Arabia announced that it would temporarily halt its military operation, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman welcomed the Saudi decision because if the military operation did continue, the famine and disease in Yemen would become more widespread. International media spread the news. Western parliaments hit out at their governments for selling arms to Saudi Arabia. After a short ceasefire, Saudi Arabia resumed its heavy airstrikes.
(laughs)
while the international image of the Saudis has been tarnished because of its heavy bombardment of Yemen, the Emiratis were secretly pushing their own agenda. They trained 35,000 Yemeni forces in Aden and other areas. They also had a plan for this strategic island named Socotra. Yemeni military forces on the island are trained by the United Arab Emirates. With their petrodollars, the Emiratis had bought mercenaries from other parts of the world as well. 1,800 paid militants from Colombia, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, and 400 mercenaries from Eritrea. It also bought off the heads of the tribes. Its influence also caused Riyadh's anger. Muslim Brotherhood is one of the oldest Islamic political parties in Egypt. Later on, it attracted many supporters in other Arab countries. They want the return of Islam in the face of nationalist and communist elements. Such parties are called Brotherhood. In Yemen, there was a brotherhood party called Isla Party. Saudi Arabia supported it, but the UAE was against it. It was clear what they were going to fight over next. In Yemen's traditional society, half of the people aren't Zaydi Shias, they are Sunnis. Brotherhood supporters seek to find a bastion among the Sunnis. More extremist groups like Al-Qaeda also try to recruit forces within the social context. The majority of Sunnis in Yemen are not inclined towards radical groups like Al-Qaeda, so brotherhood parties like ISLA have a bigger chance. After the chasm opened wider, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi deposed two of his officials who had ties with the UAE. It was obvious that the Saudis were behind it. The UAE-affiliated groups formed a transitional council and announced if Hadi does not resign, they'll topple his government within 7 days. The bloody infighting among anti-Houthi forces started, this time between UAE supporters, named the Southern Transitional Council, and Saudi supporters, namely Hadi and his forces. After Hadi's palace was besieged by the UAE-backed rebels, the clashes ended with mediation efforts. But it was clear that the Saudi project in Yemen was heavily defeated. The Emiratis had thrown down the gauntlet. They thought they could defeat the Houthis within 2 weeks, but now they were wasting $1.3 million every month for an endless war, and they had to flex their muscles to their partner, namely Saudi Arabia. And Salman had just realized that the differences within the coalition were serious. Forget about defeating the Houthis. Large cracks had appeared within his coalition. During this period, Iran secretly provided Yemenis with food and medical supplies. Because Saudi Arabia had laid siege on Yemen, and the chances for food supplies, especially from Iran, are next to nothing. But food supply wasn't enough. If Yemenis couldn't defend themselves, the humanitarian situation in Yemen would further deteriorate. In an interview with a Chinese television network on October 1, 2019, General Mohammad Baqiri, a high-ranking Iranian military official, spoke of Iran's advisory assistance to Yemen.
در مورد یمن خب راه‌های یمن کاملاً مسدود هست و امکان کمک به اونجا به شکل تجهیزات و تسلیحات وجود نداره لذا این که گفته میشه از جمهوری اسلامی ایران موشک حمل میشه به یمن دروغه و وقتی بسته کوچک دارو امکان حملش نیست چطور موشک‌های چند متری امکان حملش باشه اما کمک مستشاری و فکری ما به ارتش مردمی یمن صورت میدیم و ما در کنار مردم یمن خواهیم بود تا اینکه بتونن این تجاوز را از کشورشون دور کنن.
Yemen has the second biggest army in the Arabian Peninsula after Saudi Arabia in terms of the number of forces. The Yemeni army dates back to World War I and the independence of North Yemen. It means it's older than any other army in the peninsula. But the problem of the Houthis isn't the number of forces. The war imposed by Saudi Arabia is unequal. The Saudis buy the latest U.S. warfare at exorbitant prices, but Yemen is a poor country. The solution was to somehow tip the balance to make it an equal war. It means Yemenis should be able to take advantage of being Saudi Arabia's neighbor and threaten Saudi interests by making indigenous missiles.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The House Select Committee's investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol building has produced history's most detailed account of an American president's cruel and seditious pursuit of power. Even now, former U.S. President Donald Trump continues to push states to alter the outcomes of the 2020 presidential election. We now present you an article written by Robert Reich. The piece is titled, Trump's Attempted Coup Continues, Even After January 6 Hearings Are Over For Now. The House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the January 6 attack has finished its hearings, at least for now. But Donald Trump's attempted coup continues. He has not stopped giving speeches to stir up angry mobs with his big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. He gave another fiery address on Friday evening, 22nd of July, in Arizona. He's actively backing congressional candidates who propound his big lie. Donald Trump continues to push states to alter outcomes of the 2020 presidential election. Just recently, he urged Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss to support a resolution to retract Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes cast for Joe Biden. He's encouraging Republican lawmakers in several states to pass legislation allowing them to take over election machinery and ignore the popular vote. Meanwhile, the lives of committee members and their families have been threatened. Witnesses have received gangster-style warnings not to cooperate. The committee's message to all of America, including Republicans, stop supporting this treachery. The committee has made that treachery crystal clear. The committee has shown the deception behind Donald Trump's big lie, including Trump's Attorney General William Barr saying, I saw absolutely zero basis for the allegations, and that promoting it was a grave disservice to the country. It has demonstrated nonpartisan repulsion towards Donald Trump's attempted coup, even in Trump's White House. As former Trump aide Cassidy Hutchinson said, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie. It has made open appeals to Republican lawmakers to stop supporting the attempt. The Republican vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, warned her Republican colleagues, who are defending the indefensible, that there will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain. It has revealed how average Americans fell for Donald Trump's treachery with disastrous results. Witness Stephen Ayers, who described himself as nothing but a family man and a working man, participated in the January 6 attack because Donald Trump basically put out, you know, come to stop the steel rally, you know, and I felt like I needed to be down here. And it has reminded Americans of their duties to democracy. As committee chair Benny Thompson put it, when you're on the losing side, that doesn't mean you have to be happy about it. But you can't turn to violence. Committee member Jamie Raskin recalled Abraham Lincoln's warning that politicians who encourage mobs to rampage and terrorize will destroy the bonds of social trust necessary for democracy to function. It is impossible to know whether the hearings will lead to criminal indictments and convictions of Donald Trump and his enablers. But the hearings already appear to have convinced some Trump supporters that he's a dangerous charlatan. The percentage of Republicans who say Donald Trump misled people about the 2020 presidential election has ticked up since last month, while Trump's enormous fundraising operation has slowed down. A New York Times Siena College opinion poll recently showed that nearly half of Republican primary voters would rather vote for a Republican other than Donald Trump in 2024. History teaches us that it is possible to bring down an American demagogue by putting his wickedness on display for all to see. In 1954, I watched the Army-McCarthy hearings. The Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, whose communist witch hunt was ending careers and debasing much of the U.S. government, had charged the U.S. Army with lax security at a top-secret Army facility. The Army hired Boston lawyer Joseph Welsh to make its case. At a session on 9th of June 1954, after Joseph McCarthy accused one of Welsh's young staff attorneys of being a communist, Welsh responded in words that led to McCarthy's undoing. "Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness." When McCarthy tried to continue his attack, Welsh angrily interrupted, "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You have done enough. You have no sense of decency." Almost overnight, Joseph McCarthy's immune national popularity evaporated. Censured by his Senate colleagues, ostracized by his party and ignored by the press, Joe McCarthy died just 3 years later, 48 years old and a broken man. Now the January 6th Committee has produced history's most detailed account of an American president's cruel and seditious pursuit of power. But will it be enough to stop Donald Trump's ongoing attempted coup? That depends on whether Americans heed the committee's implicit plea to ensure that American democracy endures.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are going to talk about the family-related issues according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hausa studies, It took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about family-related issues, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. And let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode, and that is, you know, we all know that some shoes make some sounds in addition to leaving a trail or a trace, you know.
Yes.
Like a footprint. Well, but a kind of acoustic footprint, of course. You know, is it permissible for women actually to wear such shoes that make some tapping sounds?
Well, there is no harm in it in itself, provided that it does not draw the attention of other people and lead to vile consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the yardstick, the main issue or point that must be taken into consideration. Women can wear any kind of shoes,
right,
provided that they do not draw attention, and the tapping sound does not attract attention. If it does not, there is no problem in wearing such shoes in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, in wedding parties or the like, it is customary for some women, especially the bride,
yes,
to wear a special kind of clothes, like what we call a wedding gown or a wedding dress, you know, and that is transparent. These or such clothes are tight and transparent like a net.
Yeah.
Well, is it permissible for women to wear such clothes in such gatherings? I'm talking about the clothes that show the contours of the women's body, you know, or other types of dresses that show most parts of their body sometimes.
Well, It is, first of all, it's necessary to make sure if a woman wears such dresses that show the contours of the woman's body, or the dresses which are revealing or see-through, that there shouldn't be any men outside the family members to see the woman, because it's haram to wear clothes like this,
yes,
in the presence of non-mahram men, and it's necessary for the woman to observe full hijab, covering her hair, neck, and also her body parts. And also, it's not permissible for a woman to wear tight and revealing clothes in the presence of non-mahram men. But of course, if one if one is confident that there's no non-mahram man to see her, there's no problem in wearing such a dress, provided that again it should not lead to any vile consequences, and she of course should be immune from falling victim to any vile consequences or vile deeds, you know. That's very important, because wearing a dress is permissible per se, but the consequences are very more important, and they have to be taken into consideration, of course.
Well, okay.
So of course, you know, if a woman is insulated, or let's say immune from the gaze of men, to be brief, of course, there's no problem in wearing such dresses. And of course, it's necessary to make sure that wearing such a dress will not lead to any vile consequences.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chobit, our guest speaker. We are talking about family related issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Chobit, is it permissible for a devout Muslim woman to wear glittering black shoes?
Well, there is no harm and there is no objection to a woman wearing any type or any color of shoes, unless the color or the design attracts the attention of non-mahram or makes her conspicuous in the eyes of the people around her.
Right.
Because it's not permissible to wear a dress or to present oneself in a public place in such a manner that keeps her outstanding or conspicuous. So it's not permissible in that case. Otherwise, generally speaking, it's permissible for a woman to wear any kind of shoes with any color or colors or any design.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Chobit, you know, is it incumbent on Muslim women to choose black colors for their clothes or clothing? For example, their scarves, trousers, pants, dress, and the like?
Well, Islam does not recommend black color, you know. According to Islamic Sharia, if a woman or a man, let's say, performs prayer, it is discouraged, it is makruh, or abominable to wear clothes with black color. And of course, the black color is not recommended, especially when wearing when performing prayers. But generally speaking, of course, there's no objection to a woman wearing black, okay? Black shoes, black clothes, black garments and gowns. And of course, Islam is not opposed to any color. Of course, especially if you wear white, it's more, you know, psychologically, it could be more positive, more, you know, it could have a better effect on you. But generally speaking, there's no problem in wearing colors of any clothes of any color.
Mm-hmm, I see. As you rightly mentioned in one of the earlier parts of the program, that Islam is not against any specific color.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Well, another question would be that is it permissible for a woman to wear a sort of hijab, a kind of hijab or dress that trigger the attention of other people or would be somehow considered provocative? Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, to wear a chador or a veil in an unconventional way, or choose some socks with a special color or material, again, which is provoking.
Well, just as we said in my answer to the previous question, if a woman's dress, be it a kind of hijab, actually, because maybe a woman is wearing a kind of veil covering her body,
right.
Her hair and neck, but you know, it keeps her, it makes her conspicuous, it attracts the attention.
Right.
So it is not permissible for a woman to wear anything whose color, design, or manner of wearing may be attractive to non-mahram people or people who are out of the family. And of course, and also it's not permissible to wear such clothes or dresses that lead the individual to some sins or bad effects, or let's say to committing any haram action. So one has to look at whether wearing such clothes will have wild consequences or not.
Mm-hmm, I see. So they always have to be aware of their consequences.
Consequences, yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawfiq, for your nice answers to the questions related to family issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Thank you, my dear audience, for listening to this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malja ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir La ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.